Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 30th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast. A freeze warning is in effect for parts of the area until Monday morning. Overnight lows will drop into the mid-20s, with highs on Monday in the mid to upper 30s. Even though we will see plenty of sunshine, with highs in the mid to upper 30s, the feels-like temperature will be in the mid-teens for Monday morning, mid-20s by the afternoon hours. This takes us into Halloween. Highs on Halloween will be in the mid to upper 30s, with a chance of snow. Overnight lows will be in the upper teens to low 20s. Then we start to warm up. We go back into the 40s for Wednesday, 50s for Thursday and Friday, as well as the weekend and into the first part of the next week. Rain chances will pick up again as we head into the weekend and into the first part of the following week. The lead story on the front page of the Courier is titled, Popularity of Vouchers Strains Some State Coffers. Applications are exceeding projections in Iowa, others. Our journalist for this article is Jeff Mulvihill. In some states, higher-income families can now use taxpayer money to cover private school tuition, and more people than projected are taking the offer, which might force scrambles to shore up state budgets. It's especially an issue in states like Arizona and Iowa, where at least some families whose children were already in private school can now take advantage of public funding. Quote, it busts the budget because it's taking on as public expense what's previously been at private cost, said Josh Cohen, an education policy professor at Michigan State University. Advocates for school choice pitch vouchers as a way to give students in low-performing schools a way out and, increasingly, to give parents control over what their children are taught. Programs funded through vouchers, tax credits, or scholarships have been around since the 1990s and are now available in the majority of states. Whether students who change schools with the use of taxpayer money achieve better educational outcome is in dispute. Initially, the programs were designed for lower-income students, but that's changing. Since last year, 9 states have adopted programs that are phasing out, eliminating, or significantly raising income limits. 4 of them, Arizona, Florida, Iowa, and Ohio, have reported numbers with more approved applications than expected. The states might need to come up with more money for their programs as a result. In the remaining 5, it's too soon to tell the effect. Indiana has not released its data. Oklahoma's system caps total spending. Arkansas and West Virginia's are being phased in gradually. And Utah's does not start until next year. Even in the states with enrollment over projections, it's early enough in the school year that the situation is still rife with unknowns, including how many of the families approved for scholarships will use them, how much will that cost, and what lawmakers will propose to do about it. Voucher supporters say demand exceeding expectations is not a problem. Quote, it's exciting, said Ryan Cantrell, Director of Government Affairs at American Federation for Children, which pushes for the programs. Quote, I think that shows that parents want this option, that lawmakers are responding to something that families want, unquote. Aaron Gallas said he was concerned when his son was in a Southern Arizona public school previously that he was not being challenged enough academically and troubled by lessons on gender identity. So when he moved to Phoenix area last year, he found the state's empowerment scholarship account was a way to get him into a Catholic school the family may not have been able to afford otherwise. Quote, I work and I pay all those taxes the same as everyone else, he said. We as parents can have a choice as to where those funds go, unquote. It's a similar experience for Heather Stressman of Waterloo, Iowa. She said her 2 older sons, now in 7th and 8th grade, had a supportive community in elementary school, but in middle school, they witnessed bullying and fights daily, and her son, with adaptive learning needs, was not getting what he needed. Iowa has a new education savings account program, so-called, which is paying for students from families of any income to switch from public to private school, and for many already in private school, to remain there. Stressman said that allowed her and her husband to get their middle schoolers and kindergartner into Catholic school this year. They plan to enroll their three-year-old when the time comes. Quote, I want every kid, no matter where they go, to be able to have a good experience and to feel safe and to get a good learning education, she said. Opponents of the programs are bracing for lawmakers to attempt to make up for the higher costs by further cutting public school funding, even though lawmakers have not publicly threatened to do so. Quote, it's extremely frustrating because cuts are inevitably going to happen, said Beth Lewis, a former teacher who serves as executive director of Save Our Schools Arizona, which supports public schools and opposes vouchers. In Arizona, nearly 9,000 scholarships had been awarded by October 14th, a little more than lawmakers projected for the full school year. Applications have continued rolling in. The office of Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat who opposes the program, has projected the number of students enrolled in the program signed into law by her Republican predecessor could hit nearly 9% of the state's students and cost about 50% more than the Republican-controlled legislature planned for. In an October 11th report, the legislature's budget staff said it does not yet have a clearer picture of the taxpayer cost. But political leaders are still sparring over the program. Hobbs labeled the vouchers, quote, unacceptable and unsustainable, noting homeschool parents are being reimbursed for expenses including ski passes and pianos. She called on GOP officials to make changes. State House Speaker Ben Toma, a Republican, said the state's education budget is on pace to have a $77 million year-end budget surplus that could be used to cover overruns. Quote, Arizona will continue to responsibly fund students, not systems, Toma said. In Republican-controlled Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott is pushing in a current special legislative session to bring a scholarship to a state that does not have any version of vouchers now. The latest version of the proposal would cap spending. The plans are in doubt because of opposition from Democrats and some Republicans who live in rural areas where private schools are scarce and public schools are some of the most important institutions. In Ohio, families of all incomes are eligible for scholarships, but those with the highest incomes cannot get the maximum amount. The state so far has received nearly 85,000 applications for the funds. Applications are still rolling in, but not everyone who is approved will end up using the benefits. Still, a Columbus Dispatch analysis found the $398 million budget for the expanded grants was likely exceeded in September. Ohio State President Matt Huffman, a Republican and supporter of the vouchers, dismissed any concern about the state being able to cover the expense, which amounts to under 1% of the state's total budget. Quote, there's plenty of money there to pay for these, he said. Green man seeks to freeze accounts, allegedly built out of more than $119,000 in cryptocurrency scam. This story written by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Green, a Butler County man, is asking the court to freeze accounts at a cryptocurrency exchange after he was allegedly bilked out of more than $119,000. It's one of the latest court actions in response to the burgeoning pig butchering scams that encourage victims to invest in digital currency through a bogus website and then to move the stolen money through digital accounts. attorneys for Michael Bullock of Green, said people behind the scam, a woman identified merely as Jean Jessica Lee, and as many as 20 unidentified men, are likely from Turkey. According to the suit, filed by attorney Joseph Casey last week in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, the scam began in April when Jessica sent Bullock a Facebook friend request. They began communicating through the WhatsApp platform at her request, and in the following weeks developed an apparent friendship, contacting each other on a regular basis. Jessica stated she was familiar with Iowa and planned to visit. She also said she was a successful amateur crypto trader. Quote, she further represented that her success was due to information leaked by her godmother, a purported insider and analyst at an options trading firm, the lawsuit states. She offered to teach Bullock, who had no experience with cryptocurrency, how to make money trading. In July 2023, he opened an account at a crypto exchange and deposited a total of $120,000 in the following months from his checking account at a Charles City bank, record state. He also borrowed money and liquidated his 401k retirement account, putting the money into U.S. dollar coin. Jessica then showed him how to undertake his own trades and options contracts using the Zyfint exchange, giving him step-by-step instructions. A Telegram messaging app was used to communicate with Zyfint staff. Jessica also claimed she put $150,000 worth of crypto into Zyfint account in Bullock's behalf that he could later repay. Jessica then walked him through how to move funds from his account to purported Zyfint addresses, according to the lawsuit. She showed him a display that claimed he made a hefty profit with the trades, about $917,000. But in reality, the funds went to addresses controlled by Jessica and others, record state. Zyfint did not and does not exist as a legitimate website, investment platform, or cryptocurrency exchange, the suit states. When Bullock attempted to withdraw his money, people claiming to be Zyfint staff threatened him and said they wouldn't release the funds unless he supplied them with bank statements and other personal information and paid an additional $91,700. Bullock's attorney asked the court to prohibit the defendants from moving funds from the accounts. Boyfriend charged with murder in woman's 2022 death. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz, and the dateline is Waterloo. Authorities have charged a Waterloo man with murder in the 2022 death of his girlfriend. LaMarcus Lamario Martez Williams, 34, was immediately arrested for felony domestic assault after Rebecca Taylor, also known as Rebecca Todd, was found unresponsive in their Olson Road home and later died. On Tuesday, police added a charge of second-degree murder in the case. Bond for the new charge was set at $1 million. Taylor was 39, according to court records. Todd called 911 around 11 p.m. on November 30th and claimed Williams was trying to stab her at their home at 1151 Olson Road. Dispatchers could hear Williams yelling in the background as Taylor screamed for him to leave her alone, records state. Officers arrived and looked through a window, spotting Taylor on the floor. Williams barricaded the door and wouldn't allow them to enter. Police eventually forced their way inside and began CPR until paramedics arrived. She died several days later. Williams told police he punched Taylor in the head and pushed her during an argument. He said her head hit a dresser in the bedroom, according to court records. At the police station, Williams allegedly pushed a detective and ran out of the building in an attempt to escape, according to court records. He was captured when he fell down a few blocks away. Second-degree murder is punishable by up to 50 years in prison upon conviction. This wasn't the first time Williams allegedly assaulted Taylor. In April of 2022, he was arrested after allegedly punching her in the head and strangling her while holding a knife, according to court records. He was placed on probation for the incident, and a restraining order was lifted. He was also convicted for allegedly threatening to burn down another woman's home in September of 2021. Teen reports gunfire. Police investigate overnight shooting. Story by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. Police are investigating after someone opened fire on a teen earlier Friday. The 19-year-old male was walking in the 1100 block of West 6th Street around 12:45 a.m. when he was approached by a person who began shooting at him. The teen wasn't hurt, but bullets struck nearby homes, police said. Officers found spent shell casings in the area. No arrests have been made in the attack. Restitution vacated in fatal shooting. Dateline Waterloo. The Iowa Court of Appeals has vacated restitution in the case of a Waterloo woman who was convicted of lesser charges in a 2020 shooting that claimed the life of her friend. Lizandra Annette Johnson has been charged with murder for allegedly firing a single shot following a fight with Jada Young Mills and others. Young Mills died of a gunshot wound to the back. Following a trial, jurors found Johnson guilty of assault causing serious injury. She was sentenced to up to 5 years in prison and ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution to Young Mills' estate. Johnson challenged the sentence and verdict, and following the conviction, the Iowa Supreme Court, in another case, found that restitution can't be ordered unless a jury found that a defendant's acts caused the death. In a ruling issued Wednesday, the Iowa Court of Appeals ruled that principle applied in Johnson's case and noted she wasn't convicted of a homicide felony. In its ruling, the Court of Appeals also turned down Johnson's request for a new trial based on the wording of jury instructions and upheld her prison sentence on the assault charge. Sex offender with gun faces charges. Dateline Waterloo. Police arrested a sex offender on weapons charges after he was found carrying a gun on Tuesday. According to court records, officers approached Jeffrey Ryan Wilson, 36, of Olwine, in the 300 block of Webster Street around 10:10 p.m. because he had an outstanding warrant out of Hamilton County. Wilson allegedly ran from police, crossing a street before he was tackled to the ground. He then struggled and dug at his waistband, according to police. Officers found a .380 caliber Ruger pistol in his pants pocket. He told officers the handgun belonged to his wife, records state. Wilson, who has also lived in Waterloo and Cedar Falls in the past, is barred from handling firearms because of a 2007 felony drug conviction and a 2016 conviction for violating sex offender registration requirements. Police arrested Wilson for felon in possession of a firearm and interference while armed. Bond was set at $10,000. Now we turn to the Week in Iowa page, and we start with the Iowa Reps cast vote for Speaker. In the news, Iowa U.S. Representatives Ashley Hinson, Randy Feenstra, Marionette Miller-Meeks, and Zach Nunn all supported Representative Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, in his successful bid for House Speaker to end 3 weeks with no Speaker. Miller-Meeks had voted against the party's previous designee, Jim Jordan, citing concerns about the tactics used by his allies to build support. Iowa's representatives said Johnson, who was relatively unknown before Tuesday, would lead on conservative priorities like protecting the southern border and passing single-subject appropriations bills. Democrats criticized the delegation for backing Johnson, who they said supported former President Donald Trump's bid to overturn the 2020 election and opposes abortion access and gender equality. Kosovo president in Iowa. Kosovo president Vojislav Osmani was in Iowa this week for a World Food Prize conference, and she was welcomed at the Iowa State Capitol by Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds praised the relationship between Iowa and the small Balkan nation, who share a sister state partnership. Voters to weigh bond questions. Iowa voters in 50 counties will be asked to approve more than $1.7 billion in bonds for their school districts and local governments to borrow money for infrastructure projects. New school construction and renovation is the most common reason schools are planning to issue bonds. Now, under the odds and ends column, 2024 watch. South Carolina U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Tim Scott said he will double down on his efforts in Iowa, building up staff and time in the state he views as make or break for his electoral chances. And Mason City School Board. A candidate for Mason City School Board filed a harassment complaint against another candidate who mentioned her multiple times in rambling threads on X, formerly Twitter, asking her on a hot date at the Republican wingding at the Surf. The case was deemed unfounded by Mason City Police. Here's the water cooler section. Plea reversal. A teenager who was charged in a deadly 2022 shooting at a Des Moines high school has asked to withdraw his guilty plea. Octavio Lopez Sanchez Jr. pleaded guilty in August to second-degree murder and two counts of willful injury and was scheduled to be sentenced on November 7th. Next, Reynolds' endorsement. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds again said she has not ruled out making an endorsement in the Republican presidential primary, saying the 2024 election is too important. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has been joined at multiple events by Reynolds, said her endorsement would be a huge get. Now here's the In the News column. Guard, State Patrol, return from border. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds joined the Iowa National Guard and Department of Public Safety leaders this week to detail their efforts to assist Texas officials at the U.S.-Mexico border this year. 109 National Guard troops and 31 Department of Public Safety officers deployed to the border in August and September. The state spent $2 million in pandemic relief funds on the deployment. How that qualifies as pandemic relief is yet to be disclosed. Reynolds blamed President Joe Biden for what she called a crisis at the southern border. State law enforcement officers were involved in dozens of cases, including human smuggling, drug trafficking, narcotics, and more. At Reynolds' direction, the Iowa Guard had deployed to the border three times since 2020. Iowa First Gentleman receiving treatment. Iowa First Gentleman Kevin Reynolds has begun receiving radiation treatment and an oral immune therapy drug to treat the lung cancer he was diagnosed with last month, Governor Kim Reynolds said this week. Reynolds became emotional when thanking Iowans who have sent support for her husband. Bird flu appears in commercial flocks. At least three cases of avian influenza have been reported in commercial turkey flocks in Iowa this month, the first cases of the fall. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation that makes available state resources for Buena Vista County to help manage the disease. Range of topics discussed at school board forum. Only two at-large seats are contested on November 7th. That election is a week from Tuesday. Dateline Waterloo. Board of Education candidates addressed topics ranging from student engagement to teacher retention and parent involvement Tuesday during a forum sponsored by the Black Hawk County NAACP and the Black Hawk Bremer League of Women Voters. All five of the candidates running for four seats on the Waterloo Community Schools Board in the November 7th election participated. Two of them are running unopposed. Incumbent Jesse Knight to retain his Director District 3 seat and a first-time candidate, Jonathan Cox, for Director, District 2. The three others are vying for two at-large positions. That includes two familiar faces seeking re-election, Lyle Schmidt and Stacy Mills, along with newcomer John Berry. Student achievement was a central concern for the at-large candidates. For Berry, it's key that parents and teachers work together to ensure success for students. Quote, "If you do not have parents on board with teachers, then that's a problem," said the former CEO and executive director of the Tri-County Child and Family Development Council, which operates the Head Start program. Quote, "We must be cognizant of the fact that there must be a robust partnership between the parent and the teacher. I believe that I bring the significant and qualified skill set to move on that by marrying my social work background and also my executive experience in high education," unquote. Schmidt, a retired John Deere engineer and manager seeking his 10th term on the board, wants to ensure that all students are in the optimal learning environment. And during his tenure on the board, he believes there has been steady progress on the goals of the district. Graduation rates improved more than 20 points from 2000 to 2020, going from 65% to 85%. Mills, a substitute teacher seeking her second term on the board, said a main concern is student attendance issues, but she also spoke about the efforts of the district. She wants to ensure that all Waterloo School's buildings are treated with equity in terms of how education is delivered. It's important to her as well that good employees are retained. Knight also voiced concerns about the district's employees. Quote, "We need to do a much better job at retaining our teachers and supporting them," he said. His highest priority as board member is to work on the continued educational improvement of the students within the district. Knight mentioned that the graduation rates with the district have slipped a bit since the COVID-19 pandemic. District officials will have to continue working on getting those rates back to pre-pandemic levels, he said. Part of those improvements for Cox relate to the teaching of reading, which he noted is fundamental to students' belonging and engagement. Quote, "Studies have shown when students have a good sense of reading at the fourth grade level, their behavior is better," he said. Cox works as the TRIO coordinator for the University of Northern Iowa Center for Urban Education and has more than 30 years of experience in the education field. He also spoke at length on the need for inclusion within the community and said that retention of students within the district schools is important. Because of changes in state law, students have expanded options to open enroll into other school district or get state-funded educational savings accounts, which can be used to attend private schools. When a question about recent state laws pertaining to curriculum restrictions was presented during the forum, all five candidates said they would follow the law. Mills noted that a committee is in place to review any books within 2 days that parents object to. Now we have the Metro Briefs column. Waterloo hosting Mayor City Council Forum. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Rotary Club is hosting a forum for the contested Waterloo City Council and Mayor races at noon on October 30th at the Waterloo Convention Center. Steve Schmidt will moderate the forum with assistance from E.J. Gallagher. Rotarians are submitting questions ahead of time for the candidates. All local candidates were invited to attend who were in contested races. Dave Bozen is running unopposed. Please RSVP if you are planning to attend, and you can do that at their website. Cost is $20 per person for the lunch buffet served. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, October 30th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
I might not know you, but I still care about you. So if you feel hopeless or if you've been thinking about suicide, please talk to someone. A friend, parent, teacher, or coworker. If you can't talk to them or feel like you have no one there to listen, turn to Your Life Iowa. Things can get better. There are people who want to help you. Please reach out now at yourlifeiowa.org. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Now, here's Stephen King with an opinion on mass shootings. We're out of things to say. There is no solution to the gun problem and little more to write, because Americans are addicted to firearms. Representative Jared Golden from Maine's 2nd Congressional District has reversed course and says he will now support outlawing military-style semi-automatic rifles like the one used in the killing of 18 people in Lewiston this week. But neither the House nor the Senate is likely to pass such a law. And if Congress actually did, the Supreme Court, as it now exists, would almost certainly rule it unconstitutional. Every mass shooting is a gut punch, with everyone, unimaginative people say, quote, "I never thought it could happen here." But such things can and will happen anywhere and everywhere in this locked and loaded country. The guns are available and the targets are soft. When rapid-fire guns are difficult to get, things improve. But I see no improvement in the future. Americans love guns and appear willing to pay the price in blood. Now, this one comes from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, editor John Cullen. The title is Iowa's Too High Property Taxes. Iowa is sitting on a budget surplus of nearly $2 billion. So flush with all that cash, Governor Kim Reynolds wants to eliminate the state income tax. As a taxpayer, that sounds great. But as a resident, where will the money come from to pay for what we can't afford already? Storm Lake needs $80 million for water system improvements and has gone begging to the federal government without success. And the state won't share any of its wealth. Where will the money come from if income taxes are eliminated? The only alternatives are increasing property and sales taxes. Iowa's residential property taxes are already high. We have family and friends who live in Indiana, a largely rural Midwestern state that is similar to Iowa in many respects, although its population is twice as large. I decided to compare property taxes. I looked at a new home in a fast-growing metropolitan suburb and an older home in a small rural community and compared them to similar homes in Storm Lake. In both cases, Indiana property taxes were half as much as a comparable home here. That's thousands of dollars a year for most homeowners. Indiana's income tax rates are also lower than Iowa's. Indiana's rate is 3.15%. Iowa taxes range from 4.4% to 6%, although the rate will drop to a flat 3.9% in 2026. California has a reputation for high taxes, but that's not necessarily the case. Until 1978, property taxes in California, like Iowa and most other states, were adjusted annually based on property's market value. Consequently, a person of modest means could be priced out of their homes because skyrocketing market values forced skyrocketing property tax increases. Proposition 13, passed by California voters in 1978, froze property taxes on the value of the property at the time of sale. That meant your property taxes would largely remain the same as long as you owned your home. I know a man who bought a house in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1988, and he spent $200,000. That home is now worth almost $3 million, and his property taxes are still less than what we pay on our $150,000 home in Storm Lake. By the way, if I lived in California, my state income tax would be zero this year. Next, we have an editorial written by Jesse Wegman, and it appeared in the New York Times. Trump's lawyers should have known better. At a pivotal moment during one of the Watergate hearings in 1973, President Richard Nixon's counsel, John Dean, asked a question that still resonates, quote, "How in God's name could so many lawyers get involved in something like this?" Unquote. In the aftermath of Nixon's resignation, the issue posed by Mr. Dean's bracing question triggered a revolution in the legal profession. With so many lawyers involved in the Watergate criminal scheme, the American Bar Association started requiring law schools to provide ethics instruction or risk losing their accreditation. Exams began testing law students' knowledge of intricate ethical rules. It wasn't enough, if the past few weeks are any guide. In Fulton County, Georgia, three of the former President Donald Trump's lawyers, Kenneth Chesbro, Sidney Powell, and Jenna Ellis, have now pleaded guilty to crimes in service of Mr. Trump's scheme to overturn the 2020 election and stay in the White House. All three have agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in the sprawling state RICO case against Mr. Trump. Two other Trump lawyers, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, still face criminal charges in the Georgia case. They, along with Mr. Chesbro and Ms. Powell, have also been identified as unindicted co-conspirators in the related federal prosecution of Mr. Trump, which will probably benefit from the guilty pleas in Georgia. The charges in the plea agreements vary, but the underlying story is the same. 50 years after Watergate, the nation is once again confronted with a president who grossly abused the powers of his office, leading to criminal prosecutions. And once again, that abuse relied heavily on the involvement of lawyers. If Mr. Trump's 2020 racket was a coup in search of a legal theory, as one federal judge put it, these lawyers provided the theory and the phony facts to back it up. In doing so, they severely tarnished their profession. How in God's name? The question is no less urgent now than in 1973. Lawyers hold immense power within the American system of government, which depends on their expertise and their integrity to function. Those who abuse this power pose an even greater threat to the country than some random Capitol rioter, because we count on them not only to draft and execute the laws, but to follow them, to lead by example. Everyone should behave ethically, of course, but despite the, quote, "better call Saul" reputation of so many lawyers, there's nothing wrong with holding the profession to a higher standard. One can view the guilty pleas by the Trump lawyers as evidence that the system is working as it should. They broke the law, they violated their ethical obligations, and now they are facing the music, not only in the courts, but from their chosen profession. Mr. Giuliani's New York law license was suspended for his, quote, "demonstrably false and misleading statements on Mr. Trump's behalf." The District of Columbia's Bar Association has recommended he lose his license there for good. Ms. Ellis was censured by Colorado State Bar officials for violating the rule against reckless, knowing, or intentional misrepresentations by attorneys, and may face more severe consequences in light of her guilty plea. Mr. Eastman, a former law school dean and one of the key legal architects of Mr. Trump's bonkers plot to stay in office, is in the final days of his California disbarment trial for ethical violations. Officials there have argued that his conduct was, quote, "fundamentally dishonest and intended to obstruct the lawful certification of President Biden's victory." All of this is to the good. Careers are rightly ruined over such behavior. It is also the exception to the rule. In the real world, lawyers rarely face any consequences for their legal or ethical transgressions. Quote, "It's a club," said Stephen Gillers, a legal ethics expert at New York University School of Law, who has studied the profession's opaque and feckless disciplinary system. Quote, "The judges who make the decisions are lawyers in robes. They tend to be sympathetic to the other lawyer," unquote. And it's hard to gloss over the fact that a disturbing number of experienced attorneys, some of whom once held prestigious posts in government and academia, were willing and eager to tell transparent lies and concoct laughable legal arguments to help a con man stay in the White House against the will of the American people. Quote, "Part of the reason Trump had to resort to attorneys to attempt to overthrow the election was because the military was not available to him," unquote. Norm Eisen, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, told me, recalling the notorious December 18, 2020 Oval Office meeting, during which the former president openly contemplated ordering the armed forces to seize voting machines. Mr. Eisen said, quote, "It's a testament to our military leaders, to our military culture, that that door was closed," unquote. The same cannot be said, alas, for America's legal culture. It's easy enough to understand why Mr. Trump, who was mentored by the ruthless mob lawyer Roy Kahn, would seek out lawyers who were willing to do whatever he asked. Legality and ethics be damned. The more troubling question is how he was able to find so many takers. The obvious answer is the eternal seduction of money and power. Lawrence Tribe, one of the nation's foremost constitutional scholars, fell back on that explanation for the choices made by Mr. Chesbro, his former student, referring to him as a moral chameleon who was engaged in deeply dishonest lawyering. Related to this is the intense pressure to satisfy the demands of powerful clients, even if it means bringing lawsuits so frivolous that they can result in legal sanctions, as many of Mr. Trump's lawyers have learned the hard way. There is an important caveat here. Many government and private lawyers in 2020, faced with Mr. Trump's legal and unconstitutional demands, resisted the temptation and behaved honorably. From the White House Counsel's Office to the Justice Department to top law firms, some key attorneys held the line. Quote, "What was one of the determinative factors in Trump's coup failing?" asked Ian Basin, executive director of the advocacy group Protect Democracy. Quote, "Responsible lawyers refused to participate," unquote. That explains why many of the lawyers caught up in Mr. Trump's outrageous plot were not what you might call the cream of the crop. They were grifters, shysters, hair dye leakers, tapped primarily because Mr. Trump had trouble finding more serious people to take his case. And yet, there were still those with more respectable backgrounds, like Mr. Chesbro, who chose to sell their honor to a man devoid of it, and who they should have known wasn't going to pay them anyway. In the end, they were all smeared with the humiliation of having filed meritless, fact-free cases. With one minor exception, federal and state courts rejected every lawsuit brought on behalf of Mr. Trump. To a degree many people didn't fully realize until the past few years, the functioning of American government depends on honor. Quote, "There are no guarantees in a democracy," Mr. Eisen said. Quote, "Our rule of law is a central part of what defines our democratic system. Ultimately, it comes down to whether the majority of people will do the right thing," unquote. When it comes to lawyers, the choices of just a few can make all the difference. And now from Art Cullen in the Storm Lake Times pilot, Destroying Agriculture. Unexpectedly strong opposition to carbon dioxide pipelines in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa has caused the cancellation of the Navigator project that would have run through Buena Vista County. The Summit project, slated for Cherokee County, is in trouble because regulators would not issue permits for their routes. This has made the ethanol industry nervous. a statement from the Iowa Renewables Fuel Association is as follows. Quote, over the last year, we have been disappointed with the amount of disinformation that has been spread among the public and the regulators across multiple states. That does not happen by accident. Rather, it is being pushed by groups who oppose modern agriculture and whose stated mission is to destroying farming as we know it, unquote. The Dakotas are not known for opposing modern agriculture. Hog confinements are sprouting up in South Dakota as corn planting rises, so that doesn't add up. North Dakota is hardly the land of environmental activists. They like their meat in Bismarck. And most of the holdup in Iowa is from farmers who are trying to preserve their property. They want a proper price for top-notch ground, maybe. Or they just don't like intruders, whether they be wind turbine transmission lines or pipelines. These people are not out to, quote, destroy farming as we know it, unquote. IRFA warns that without pipelines and the unstated federal payments that would route to ethanol plants, we could revert to a 1990s-like era of corn surpluses. Pipelines will facilitate the development of biofuels for aviation. We do suffer from too much corn production, for sure. We also suffer from a lot of environmental problems associated with corn production. To suggest that, quote, modern agriculture has been kind to rural Iowa would be Pollyannish. It could use some amendment. The corn, soy, ethanol, hog complex in Iowa has eliminated the independent livestock producer. It has fouled the drinking water sources for Des Moines. The ethanol livestock complex is depleting the Jordan and Dakota aquifers. It suffocates the Gulf of Mexico. We have so much corn that if we don't burn it, chaos will ensue. The Middle East reminds us that ethanol is an important element in our immediate national security. It helps corn prices. Ethanol is not a long-term solution, and we cannot sustain the model of, quote, modern agriculture in its exact form, nor should we. It drives people off the land. It shrivels up small towns. It pollutes the air and water. Nobody is out to destroy farming. To suggest that carbon pipelines somehow are crucial to the future of Lawrence or Albert City is absurd. They are conveyances for tax revenue to investors, ethanol plants, and willing landowners. They are not solutions to our climate problems or our chronic overproduction of corn. We could be producing biomass on marginal corn acres that produces hydrogen if Iowa leaders got into that game instead. That would not involve anhydrous ammonia, Roundup, or patented seed. It would involve grass. You could even forget about the hydrogen and graze half of our corn acreage for the benefit to independent farmers and the environment. That would be sustainable and productive, but it does not necessarily serve, quote, modern agriculture. Next, by Jamel Bowie, and appeared in the New York Times, Mike Johnson is a right-wing fever dream come to life. Last week, on the eve of his first attempt to become Speaker of the House, allies of Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio confidently predicted that his more mainstream and institutionalist opponents would cave rather than resist his ascent. Jordan's allies were wrong about that particular caving, but they were right that those moderates and institutionalists would eventually fall in line with the far right of the House Republican Conference, because on Wednesday they did just that. After 3 weeks of chaos, the House Republican majority finally chose a speaker. The lucky legislator, Representative Mike Johnson from Louisiana's 4th Congressional District, a four-term backbencher with little leadership experience, Johnson was too obscure to have enemies, giving him an easy ride to the top after three previous nominees, Steve Scalise, the House Majority Leader, Jordan, the first chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, and Tom Emmer, the House Majority Whip, faltered in the face of opposition. After winning a nearly unanimous vote of the House Republican majority, one member was absent, Johnson became the 56th Speaker of the House of Representatives. Mike Johnson is neither a moderate nor an institutionalist. Just the opposite. A protege of Jordan's, he comes, as you have doubtless heard, from the far-right anti-institutionalist wing of the Congressional Republican Party. And while he was not a member of the Freedom Caucus, he did lead the Republican Study Committee, a group devoted to the proposition that any dollar spent on social insurance is a dollar too much. When push came to shove, in other words, the supposedly moderate members of the House Republican Conference were happy to defer to their most extreme colleagues on substance, if not style. And what does Johnson believe? He is staunchly against the bodily autonomy of women and transgender people and supports a nationwide ban on abortion and gender-affirming care for trans youth. He is also virulently anti-gay. In 2003 essay, Johnson defended the laws that criminalized homosexual activity between consenting adults. In 2004, he warned that same-sex marriage was a, quote, dark harbinger of chaos and sexual anarchy that could doom even the strongest republic, unquote. Last year, Johnson introduced legislation that has been compared to Florida's Don't Say Gay law, and he continues to push to overturn the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide in 2015. If Johnson is known for anything, however, it is for his tireless advocacy on behalf of Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Johnson wrote one of the briefs purporting to give a legal justification for throwing out the voting results in several swing states. He advanced the conspiracy theory that Venezuela was somehow involved in the nation's voting machines. On January 6, 2021, he urged his Republican colleagues to block certification of the election on the grounds that state changes to voting in the face of the pandemic were illegitimate and unconstitutional. When questioned during his first news conference as Speaker whether he stood by his effort to overturn the 2020 election, he ignored the question, and his fellow Republicans shouted down the reporter who asked it. The new Speaker is, in short, an election-denying extremist who believes that his allies have the right to nullify election results so that they can impose their vision of government and society on an unwilling public. He is Jim Jordan in substance, but not Jim Jordan in style, which was enough for Republicans to come together to make him the leader of the House and second in line to succeed the President of the United States in case of emergency. The fractious House Republican majority cannot agree on how to fund the government. It cannot agree on whether to fund the government. It cannot agree on the scope of federal spending. It cannot even agree on whether it should do anything to govern the nation. But it can agree, it seems, to hand the reins of power to someone who showed no hesitation when asked to help overturn American democracy. During the summer of 2012, President Barack Obama told supporters that if he won the White House again, it would break the fever among Republicans. Instead, after Mitt Romney lost to Obama, the party embraced the worst version of itself and nominated Trump in 2016 and 2020. After Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential election, he expressed his hope that this time, with Trump's departure from power, the Republican fever would finally break. Instead, the Republican Party went even deeper into the hole, hailing the former president's failed attempt to keep himself in office as another lost cause and defending his leadership again and again. It's not that the fever won't break. It's that there is no fever to break. The far-right extremism and open contempt for democracy that mark much of the modern republicanism are not aberrations. It's not a spell that might fade with time. It is the Republican Party of 2023, and it will be the Republican Party of 2024. And while Trump may, for either legal or political reasons, eventually leave the scene, there's no reason to think the Republican Party will revert to a state in which the Mike Johnsons are back on the sidelines. Next, Allen Hospital installs new PET CT scanner, Dateline Waterloo. Unity Point Health Allen Hospital installed an in-house positron emission tomography, computed tomography, PET CT scanner, to enhance convenience and accessibility for patients seeking diagnosis and undergoing treatment for several medical conditions. The equipment combines functional information from a PET scan along with anatomical imaging from a CT scan in one exam. This provides more details related to metabolic changes to aid in the diagnosis and treatment of serious illnesses such as cancer, heart disease, and brain disorders. While Allen Hospital has offered these services in the past, the new equipment will provide greater scheduling flexibility and timely examinations. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, July 30th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around Iowa that we read. Just go to our website, that is, iowaradioreading.org. Do that at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.